I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, David Remnick talks to Columbia University professor Mark Lilla. In his new book, Lilla argues that a focus on identity politics is crippling the Democratic Party.
Stephen Bannon is gone from the White House. But the legacy is clear. Together with Donald Trump, Bannon made hostility toward identity politics and political correctness a pillar of the new Republican Party. But that view is not only to be found on the right. Mark Lilla is a Democrat, a self-described liberal and a Columbia professor of the humanities, who's been saying very much the same thing. As Lilla sees it, activists and identity groups on the left, of color, of sexual orientation, any number of identities, are losing elections for the Democratic Party, at least in part. He elaborates on this phenomenon in a new book called The Once and Future Liberal. I talked with Mark Lilla last week.
There is a quote recently that Steve Bannon, of all people, delivered. The Democrats, the longer they talk about identity politics, I've got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity, and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats. And you have said it works for them, it being identity politics. It doesn't work for us. And there seems to be some link, not that I'm saying that your politics by any chance are the same as Steve Bannon's, but you're saying a similar thing, aren't you?
I just think it's an objective fact. He has no reason to lie about this. And the past two generations of our politics, I think, demonstrates exactly that, that works for their side and it doesn't work for our side for all kinds of reasons. Now, that is not to say that we don't talk about identity. To understand any social problem in this country, you have to understand identity. And we're more aware of that than ever, and that's been a very good thing. But to address those problems with politics, we have to abandon the rhetoric of difference in order to appeal to what we share so that people who don't share this identity somehow can have a stake and feel something that other people are experiencing. To give you an example, I'm not a black motorist. I will never be a black motorist. I don't know what it's like to look in the rearview mirror of a car and see the lights flashing and feel my stomach churn, right? But I am a citizen, and that person is a fellow citizen. And if we can make the case that citizens in this country, that there are citizens in this country who can't just go for a drive without being worried about this, and they won't be equally protected by the law, I think I can make the case to people who aren't black that that's a terrible thing, right? And so I want to frame the issue in terms of basic values and principles that we share in order to establish sympathy and empathy and identification with someone else.
But Mark, what are you asking African-Americans to do? Be a little less specific, a little more polite somehow? You're asking them to be less aggressive in their demand for justice, whether it's on the road or on the street? I'm not quite – this is where I understand the overall yearning for a more generalized rhetoric of us, of liberal values, of civil rights. I'm not sure why you have the disdain you do, the suspicion that you do for a group like Black Lives Matter, that you're saying that they are going about it in all the wrong way, or unless I'm misunderstanding.
Well, I mean, to read the full passage of what I said about Black Lives Matter, I said Black Lives Matter is a textbook example of how not to build solidarity. There's no denying that by publicizing and protesting police mistreatment of African Americans, the movement mobilized supporters and delivered a wake-up call to every American with a conscience. I'm totally on board with that, right?
So what did Black Lives Matter do that you're at best ambivalent about and very critical, really?
Right, and then I say, but there's no denying that the movement's decision to use this treatment to build a general indictment of American society and its law enforcement institutions and to use Mau Mau tactics to put down dissent and demand a confession of sins and public penitence played into the hands of the Republican
right. But Mark,
right.
Mau Mau tactics. Are you familiar?
Of course I remember. What was that confrontation they had with Hillary Clinton, if not that, right? They were shouting down people at various venues. No, those are Mau Mau tactics, sure.
You're comfortable with that phrase?
Sure. I mean, you know, Mau Mau tactics, I'm also thinking of—
No, I remember the opening of the Tom Wolfe piece.
Tom Wolfe, right?
But I also know where Tom Wolfe stands politically, and which is far, much farther than you're saying you are to the right. And so
I'm not to the right, but—
So some of the criticism that's aimed at your book has less to do with the generalized demand for a more common politics and a desire to win than it is for a certain tonal thing. There's a tone to the book that you have been offended by politics on campus in a way that seems outsized. Can you address that? What's been your experience on campus of identity politics that offends you?
Well, to begin with, what leads to my frustration and my tone is that I'm sick of noble defeats. I'm tired of losing. I'm sickened by the fact that Donald Trump is in power right now. And not just that, but that Republicans control 2/3 of our state legislatures, 2/3 of our governorships, 24 states outright. They win 2 more. They can call a constitutional convention. Mm-hmm. To my mind, that is the biggest threat to every group that Democrats care about. That's the most important threat.
And it's impossible to have both at once. You can't have a winning strategy without maintaining some semblance of a concentration on identity.
Well, when it comes to this, the distinction I'm trying to make between analyzing a social problem and developing a political program in order to win power, you know, people who are in movement politics fail to see the distinction, I think, because identity politics is maximalizing. That's how you succeed. You see this as the only issue, right? There's a difference between speaking truth to power and seizing power to defend the truth. And those require very different things, right?
Unless I misread your book, you seem to say that in the interest of winning, and politics is about power ultimately, that the Democratic side ought to think about abandoning certain issues, certain kinds of rhetoric in order to win. But abandoning certain things like full-throated opposition to bathroom bills will mean that certain people, transgender people, some of the most vulnerable people in our society, will get hurt. How does a party go about sacrificing people on the altar of the general good?
Well, my main point is this, and I want to get this across. We cannot do anything for these groups we care about if we do not hold power. It is just talk. Therefore, our rhetoric in campaigning must be focused on winning so then we can help these people. An election is not about self-expression. It's not a time to display everything we believe about everything. It's a contest. And once you hold power, then you can do the things you want to do. So your rhetoric has to be mobilizing, and it's got to mobilize.
But you can imagine how outraged a transgender person would feel about such a tactic.
Of course, of course. And the situation of transgender people is you know, can be very, very difficult, especially young people who feel trapped in a body, and suicide rates are terrible and homeless rates are terrible. But let's be concrete about this. Transgender people make up less than 0.5% of the country. There is no electoral group that we're trying to mobilize. That's not to say that we don't want to help them and focus on that when we analyze our problems and when we get into power. But that is not how you seize power in this country, especially in the states we need to win. Look, we have the two coasts. We need to go to the middle of the country. It's a question of vision. And you know, what was extraordinary about Reagan is that up until 1980, the Republican Party had all these warring factions and they didn't have one message. And once Reagan offered this vision of the very simple vision of the country, all of those groups, the differences between those groups became much less important because they all saw themselves in this vision. And that's what has to happen to us. That we need to be able to put forward a vision so that African Americans look at it and say, those are the principles I stand for. And white working class people look at it too, and they aren't thinking so much about their differences.
Mark, you mentioned Joe Biden as somebody who gets it. Joe Biden was probably the clearest and foremost voice for gay marriage in the Obama administration.
Oh, of course, yeah. But how do we get gay marriage? It was not just that there was a fiat from above. On the contrary, is that this change happened socially. It happened in families. It happened at dinner tables when children came out to their parents. Sometimes parents came out to their kids, right? So,
but it also happened because you had people in the streets shouting, "We're here, we're queer," which is something that in the book that you say will only get you a pat on the head. Didn't that help get power too? Didn't Stonewall help get power? Civil rights movement helped get power?
Well, Stonewall certainly mobilized people to then focus on particular pieces of legislation and also to mobilize in order to get research and work on AIDS, HIV. But that's, again, just to focus on one particular issue and one particular group. And if each group is just thinking about itself, it's not thinking like a party. Party politics right now has to come first, because we cannot help any of these people if we don't get elected. And as long as we think of ourselves as groups and think now, as the Democratic Party is, which has me worried, that now they have to just add another group or shift to another group, which is the white working class, we're not going to get anywhere.
If you look at those movements, though, there are more radical voices and less radical voices. You look at the AIDS activism. Larry Kramer was a radical voice and said things and still says things that make people crazy and it seems extreme and all the rest. But couldn't you argue that it depends on where you are in time? In other words, without a Larry Kramer, without some of the radicals in the civil rights movement or in the women's rights movement, that in fact things might not push forward quite as well or quite as quickly or quite as effectively. But in real time, when you're experiencing those radical voices, and sometimes they say things that are outrageous or ridiculous, the tendency is to be dismissive of them or to find them ridiculous.
Yeah, I see that. But, you know, every time I look at a documentary, say, about the civil rights movement or about the African-American experience, and it comes to the 60s, and Stokely Carmichael comes on, I'd follow him anywhere.
Because of what he's saying or because of his magnetism?
His magnetism and his willingness to call a problem what it is and to not beat around the bush, he was extraordinary. And so when you see a clip of him next to Dr. King, King pales, right? Do I think that Stokely Carmichael and the groups he represented did anything to help persuade white America about race? I don't think so. And I think Dr. King did. Though the appeal for me, just given my personality,
A lot of white kids went down south to follow Stokely Carmichael every bit as much as Martin Luther King and leaders of SNCC.
Oh, if you're talking about white liberals, yes. I'm talking about the attitudes towards race of other sorts of people.
Mark, you've described a kind of scheme in our recent politics of two, you call them dispensations, the Roosevelt dispensation and the Reagan dispensation. Is it your hope somehow to return to the Roosevelt dispensation, the idea that government exists to solve problems?
No, that can't be done because our situation is very different. To begin with, we've learned that the government can only do so much and that certain programs don't work, and we understand that better. The economic situation is completely different. We have a globalized economy. It's no longer possible to organize labor in the way we used to. Women are part of the workforce. All kinds of things have changed. But our basic principles, I think, haven't changed, and that is that we stick together. Citizens are not roadkill. We take care of each other. And secondly, that we stand for the equal protection under the law. And if we can only articulate what those two principles might mean in the present, I think we would be able to move on from our obsession with or our self-limitation to identity in order to reach out to people we haven't been able to reach out to.
Mark Lilla, thank you very much.
Okay, that was fun. Thanks.
That was Mark Lilla talking to David Remnick.